Somewhere I tried to put all this together for you, because many of you were not here and then you haven't seen this before. So this talk is about the uses of effective field theory techniques or ideas originally developed in particle physics to study gravitational dynamics, from black holes to cosmology, on the shoulders of particle physics. So this is an incomplete, somewhat incomplete list of effective theory applications in gravity that I've been working on. And don't panic, I'm not going to cover all this in detail. So I'm going to mostly talk about NRGR, but I'm also going to talk about effective field theory ideas, or briefly, I'm going to talk about effective field theory ideas to describe dissipation and absorption in black hole dynamics, effective field theory of inflation, in particular also to include dissipative effects, effective field theory approach to high energy gravitational scattering, and some work in progress that I'm not going to mention, just as some advertising, on effective field theory approach to cosmological perturbation theory or structure formation, and in hydrodynamics. So, Chapter one, so I'm gonna focus about NRGR, and I'm gonna describe a little bit more about it throughout the talk. This is an effective theory approach to compute gravitational wave radiation from binary black hole and neutron star systems. So the main idea is to use these effective theory techniques to disentangle all the relevant scales in the problem that I'm gonna talk about in more detail later on, which are the size of the objects, in this case black holes, or compact objects such as neutron stars, the scale of the forces or the separation of the objects, which is this 1 over r scale, and the much longer scale of the radiation, which is you can call lambda, which is an order of r over v, or the scale of the energy or the frequency, if you want, which is v over r. So the main idea is how to solve the gravitational dynamics in terms of effective theory techniques or a bunch of Feynman diagrams. So, what is the motivation? So most of you were here yesterday. We heard Professor Narayan. I don't know if he's here now. I don't see him. Oh, I see, okay. So he gave a great talk, and it was very nice to see how much we have learned about black holes. So we learned a great deal about black holes, but imagine how much more we can learn if we actually smash them into each other. And that's, I should use the thing. And that's our large black hole collider, so which is essentially LIGO. LIGO is a Lasser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, which is going to see, we're going to observe the decay product of this collisions of black hole or the merger of black holes. LIGO is a large collaboration, as you can see here, which CETA and PI are part of. This is an aerial picture of the LIGO Observatory in Louisiana. And you see, I don't know if you can see here, these are 4 kilometers long arms. And currently, LIGO is undergoing an upgrading. And by 2014, they're going to increase the sensitivity for a factor of 1,000. And optimistic people will claim that you can see of the order of maybe 100 events a year, more likely over the 10th of events a year. Once we reach the design sensitivity, and you see here, which type of frequencies LIGO operate between 10 hertz, which is mostly what ground-based detectors can achieve. This is the seismic wall. This is due to basically fluctuations in the gradients, or basically what you can think about fluctuations on the potential that causes, like the gravitational potentials, which causes, for example, seismic uncertainties in the free-falling pendulums that are basically in these two arms, which is how this interferometer works. Is basically you send back and forth light between these arms, and you're going to try the same way the Michelson interferometer works. So basically this is something that ground-based detectors cannot do anything about, and the scale of the 1,000 hertz or the kilohertz essentially here is because LIGO is mostly sensitive to binary neutron stars or solar mass black holes. And if you roughly estimate what is the typical frequencies of binary black holes, like solar mass black holes and neutron stars, which is roughly 1 over the mass, it comes out around the kilohertz. So this is essentially which is the band that LIGO operates.
What are all the resonances?
Sorry?
What are all the resonances?
This spikes?
Yeah.
Actually, I'm not sure. Do you know what this?
Some of them are binary modes, then you have 60 hertz mode from the transmission lines.
Those are very well mapped.
It's understood, yeah. Some of them are very well understood. The other ones, okay, they just have models for the noise, and then they have all sort of way to try to tell whether it's noise or not, because remember, they have more than one.
So the cool thing is that we are reaching down to design sensitivity by 2014, and LIGO eventually is going to measure gravitational waves. And the cool thing is that we not only have one interferometer, this is a network of, it's an international network of gravitational wave interferometers. This is not just the LIGO that I was showing here. This is the one in Louisiana down here. But we also have one in Washington, in the state of Washington, near Hanford. There's one in Japan, which is, these are 4 kilometers interferometers. This is a 300 interferometer, but it's also the technology of the Japanese people are some of the techniques that are actually going to eventually the design sensitivity of these detectors, even though they don't reach the 4 kilometers that you need for the type of signals that I'm going to describe. This is very good eventually to be able to have like a network of interferometers to produce accurate measurements. So even though TAMA right now might not be able to reach the sensitivity that LIGO is going to reach, in the future we expect to have a full array of gravitational wave interferometers, with one in Hanover, one in Vigo that is actually reaching the same sensitivity. This is a LIGO-Vigo collaboration, which is going to be it's going to be very useful in the future to have confidence about gravitational wave detection, to extract accurate waveforms, also to be able to pinpoint where the signal is coming. And eventually, this is something that we are right now, that the LIGO collaboration is trying to achieve, is find some country in the southern hemisphere where to put another interferometer, because all these are in the northern hemisphere. So we wanna put some interferometer also to have it in the southern hemisphere. And there are talks about Australia has originally Australia was one of the countries that was gonna host one of these interferometers. Right now there are talks about putting one in India. So there's a big international effort to detect gravitational waves, which is opening a new era of gravitational wave astronomy, because we're gonna open a new window into the universe. I'm going to test now that we're going to be able to test the last force in nature. So basically, we have all the fundamental forces in nature. We haven't tested gravity yet at the very strong gravitational regimes, which is what LIGO is going to observe. And this is what we're very excited. So what is the future, though? If this is what we're seeing right now, which is what the gravitational wave international network of ground-based detectors is currently operating, and by 2015 we should start seeing something in particular in the LIGO detectors. In the future, we expect also to have space-based detectors, such as the laser interferometer space antenna, or ELISA. This is our linear collider, if you want. If you remember the sensitivity course that I was showing before for LIGO, the LIGO detectors have the seismic walk around 10 hertz. And this is due to the ground base. And as I was saying, this is because they have this error induced by the fluctuations in the gradients of the potential, the gravitational potential induced by the Earth. So that's not going to happen if you put these guys in space. So you see here the curves, the sensitivity curves, the frequencies are much lower. So you can actually go to much higher mass. Remember, it scales like 1/mass. So you go to lower frequency, you can actually probe now masses up to like supermassive black holes of the order 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6. You're also going to be sensitive to the extreme mass ratio in spirals when you have a big black hole and a small particle orbiting around it. And all other sources, such as galactic binaries that we know out there, and LISA's going to observe. Unfortunately, we don't know yet what's going to happen with LISA. Right now, it's moved to Europe. The Europeans are voting about, I think in June, they're going to be decided where LISA is going to be put forward. But there's a lot of very cool physics that can be done with gravitational wave astronomy. And this is about like a very short summary of what can we learn. How can we test this barbed side of the universe? Or what kind of physics can we extract from gravitational wave observation? As I was saying, so LIGO and LISA are sensitive to the coalescence of neutron stars or binary black holes. So these are colossal events. So this is gravity put at the string. So space-time put probe under a very extreme condition. So this is going to be the highest precision test of general relativity that you could possibly imagine. from precisely the most accurate description of relativistic system in strong gravitational fields. And this is also very clean because it's gravity basically. All the information that's going to be coming off this event is going to be very pretty much undisturbed and reach us in the detector, contrary to the case of photons or electromagnetic radiation that gets absorbed all the way to as it propagates to us. And as we learn, for example, from Professor Narayan, it's very hard, for example, to determine the spin of the supermassive black holes. In this case, with gravitational wave measurement, this is actually going to be, we're going to be able to measure the spin of the black holes to the percent level. Not only spins, but also masses that he showed us. He had very large uncertainties. The masses and the spin of black holes with gravitational wave observations, we're going to be able to measure it to very high accuracy. So tests of GR, very precise tests of GR, very nice, very precise measurements of masses and spin. But we can also do fundamental physics. We can also learn, for example, putting bounds on light particles, for example, axions, this idea of the axiverse. So string theory gives us all these very light particles, very light axions. So imagine if black holes have like a disk of axions, like a bound state of axions around them. So once you know, for example, that the spin of that black hole, as we learned from Professor Narayan, so we learn about superradiance, so this Penrose process, that you know that you have this effect that it can slow down the spin of the black hole. You can extract energy from the spin of the black holes. So when the typical length of the scale of these light axions, which is given by the mass of the axions, reaches the size of the black holes, then you can have this superradiance effect, and that black hole is going to spin down. So that you can observe by measuring the spin and the masses very accurately. And if you see these gaps in spin and mass, you can actually put bounds on these light particles. So you can do a lot of cool physics with black hole spectroscopy. You can also test matter at high pressure and density because the neutron stars, for example, are going to get very close to each other. The signal, the gravitational wave signal is going to depend on the inner structure of the compact objects. And therefore, we can learn about the quaternion states and matter and QCD at very high pressure and density. Eventually, we can also learn about gravitational waves from primordial fluctuations. This is a very long shot, but we can learn about the gravitational waves produced during the early universe, the epoch of inflationary dynamics. These are actually very low frequency because remember, the universe stretches, so these are very long wavelengths, very short frequencies. LISA, as it is designed now, doesn't seem to be reaching to very low frequencies, but in the future, we might be able to actually probe the very early universe. And of course, every time we have new physics, every time we have a new windows to the universe, and we want to learn about what is out there, for example, at the LHC, we better understand your background very well, for example, your QCD background. So you have to understand like the survey population. You have to understand what is out there in terms of black hole binaries, neutron star binaries, to be able to distinguish what kind of other physics you can learn, what kind of new phenomena you can learn from gravitational waves. So let me give you in a very, very small nutshell what is in a waveform? So what is it in the signal that we're going to observe in the gravitational wave interferometer? So essentially, you see here, this is a cartoon representation of what the waveform looks like, or how is the distance between the arms changing with time as the gravitational wave comes. You know, gravitational wave have two polarizations. So you have, if you think about, for example, a ring of particles, you see this as the gravitational wave comes, you see these oscillations, and that's what we measure as an interferent pattern in the interferometers. So basically, if we're thinking about the LIGO band, which is between these 10 hertz and the kilohertz, that is basically neutron star binaries or like solar mass or dark solar mass black holes binary systems. So these guys have been orbiting each other for a long time. There is some dissipative dynamics that actually bring this together, some kind of friction. And by the time they enter the LIGO band, they're actually fairly close. They're around like 300 kilometers apart. And they're moving sufficiently fast, so it's lower than the percent of the speed of light. So they merge in about 5 minutes. But the cool thing is that even though they merge in about 5 minutes, there's an order of thousands of cycles, like 10,000 times these guys go around. So there is a lot of information in those very last 5 minutes of the merger. Most of the part of the merger occurs in what is called the spiral phase. And this is when perturbation theory or the post-Newtonian equations actually apply. So basically here, the particles are moving non-relativistically, as I was saying, it's a tenth of a percent. So you can do expansions in V over C. As these guys coalesce, they enter the merging phase in which all this analytic perturbation breaks down because this piece becomes like a 0.6, 0.7. We don't trust expansion anymore. Then we talk to Luis, and he tells us how to run the code for the last, say, tens of orbits. And then we have the ring down, which is the part which we understand with perturbation theory. These are basically the quasi-normal ringing modes of the black hole. So needless to say, to do good science, so the scientific output of gravitational wave physics is going to rely upon having accurate templates. This is something that we're going to see in the detector. And this is, can I see it? Well, you cannot see it. But this will be the theoretical template. So we want this guy to match accurately so we can get the best physics out of it. Therefore, we need to compute this very accurately to get these waveforms very accurate. And that means that we had to compute like the waveforms, for example, in this spiral phase, which is encompasses a lot of cycles, to high orders in the post-Newtonian expansion. So for example, if I want to compute the phase, which is the gravitational wave phase, what I need to compute is like the binding energy of the system and the flux. And this is very, very simple. What I'm trying to do is just to basically integrate the frequency as a function of time. But since I don't know the function of the frequency, a function of time, so I just do a change of variables and integrate it as a function of the velocity or as a function of the frequency. So if you know the flux and if you know the energy as a function of the frequency or as a function of the velocity, you can extract the phase in what is called the adiabatic approximation, in which basically by the time that this guy enters the LIGO band, they move in circular orbits, so we can basically compute the phase as an average in terms of the average flux in the system. So this is what we want to compute. Okay, so this is the introduction. We can do a lot of cool stuff with gravitational waves. We have a lot of detectors out there, not only ground-based, eventually space-based detectors, or with other interferometers, which I didn't mention. There's a group in Stanford thinking about detecting gravitational waves with atom interferometers.
Aren't there claims?
Sorry?
Aren't there claims that those don't work?
There's some disputes. Yes, the people from the Stanford group will tell you that those claims that don't work are not correct, but let's not enter in that discussion. In any case, LIGO by 2014-15, advanced LIGO should start seeing gravitational waves. And once we pass the excitement and the champagne of the detection, we start doing physics with it. So the point is that we want to get this very accurately. So we want to do science with it. And let me show you how this is done in the traditionally. Okay, this, you guys probably all know this. So you have to solve Einstein equation. So you want to compute this waveform, which is this H here. So you solve Einstein equations, you span in the weak gravity field. You basically have the weak gravity approximation in which you have the usual box H equal T mu nu. However, it's not only the source. You have a bunch of nonlinear corrections as well. So all the nonlinearities of GR will enter in the pseudotensor, which is this guy over here. So this is an expansion. And so what is the expansion here? Well, the first thing is that in the traditional approach, which I'll show you a little bit more in a second, the T mu nu of the sources are basically treated in a point particle approximation. So this is why you have a delta function here. But then you see factors of velocity. So you see right away that you can expand this guy in factors of V from the velocities here and from the proper time. So there are a bunch of powers of velocity here which enter in this part. Now here, you'll say, where are the powers of velocity? Well, there are no powers of velocity per se, but there are powers of Gm over R. Essentially, each guy H here, if you think about the H to be like a potential, which is like the phi, the 1 plus 2 phi that gives you the H, is the scale of H is order Gm over R. And Gm over R, if you're in a bound state in which the potential and kinetic energy are roughly of the same order, scales like V squared. So this expansion, which is an expansion in Gm over R, turns out to be an expansion in V squared. So everything here can be expanded in the power of velocity, and that's called post-Newtonian expansion. So 1pn is V squared, mpn is V to the 2n, and so on. But remember, these are two different expansions, one in the size of the object, if you want, or the compactness over the separation, and another one in the kinetic part, which how fast you're going. However, those two expansions are related, and everything turns out to be an expansion in velocity.
Yeah.
Exactly. But to leave in order, I know how you scale. The corrections here are going to be Gm over R. It's going to be order 1, and then I don't trust my expansion anymore. But at leave in order, the first correction, which is the Gm over R potential, as long as V is less than 0.3, say, you can trust this approximation. It doesn't matter whether I have plus dot, dot, dot. All the 1 over R squared, they're all subleaving. I'll show you exactly how we power count that. That's exactly what we want to compute, precisely the corrections, which are all the subleading corrections to this relationship. So at leading order, this expression holds. The corrections are gm over r squared, and those are v squared corrections now. I'll show you how Einstein computed those, for example. So this is how it's traditionally done. This is the advanced calculus part, or the traditional approach. So you go to higher orders, you have to iterate. Now there is a problem, because I told you have delta function sources. When you iterate, you have to basically square a delta function. When you square the delta function, it blows up. So they run into all kinds of problems. So this is just one page. This goes on for pages and pages. This is a collaboration between French, Germans, and even Clifford Will was trying this computation. Clifford actually got the 2 p.m. right, but at 3 p.m. he got of order of 1,000 parameters. He didn't know where there were gauge parameters, there were finite size parameters. He didn't know what to do with it. He basically gave up. But Blanchet and Damour, and eventually Schaefer and people in Japan and so on, they tackled the 3 p.m. result, and they actually finished it about 10 years ago. However, the procedure is very unsystematic. It's not clear that you can extend this formalism to higher order. It's not clear how to regularize these divergences that arise because of the point particle approximation, because of nonlinearities of GR. You see here, these terms here are regularization pieces that they call Leibniz. Because of they use the Leibniz regularization or Adamard regularization or Partifini, who knows what. The point is that it's very super ambiguous because they don't exploit the powers of a symmetry. You're an effective field theorist, so you're a field theorist. You have to regularize a computation. You run into divergences of Einstein equations, say. Well, why not write at the level of the action and look for the counterterms? Look for the terms in the action that you can write down that will regularize your divergences. All these terms and more, like pages, they could all derive for just one single term in your action. So why not work at the level of the action and make it systematic? Because you have to exploit the powers of the symmetries. This breaks all the symmetries. In fact, they have to impose the symmetries by hand at the end of the computation, like Poincaré invariance and so on, to fix a lot of ambiguities that they have in the computation. They have a bunch of parameters here that they have to fix by hand by imposing the symmetries. You can do that from the very beginning by working from the level of the action in a field theory approach. Moreover, they don't know how to include spin degrees of freedom or finite size effects for that matter. So how do you include all this system? How do you solve the problem systematically instead of trying to solve Einstein equations by brute force? And this is when we come to NRGR. So NRGR, or non-relativistic general relativity, is an effective field theory to compute gravitational wave radiation or to solve those equations that I was telling you there, but in an efficient way. And what do I mean by an efficient way? Well, I would be lying if I told you that this was originally developed just to solve this problem. In fact, the original idea of using effective field theory techniques for this kind of problems where you have a very clear separation of scales, it has an old story, for example, in QCD to compute like the binding energy of heavy quarks. And then you see, you might naively think that those two problems have nothing to do with each other, but in fact, they're very similar. So here, in the case of the heavy quarks, the way the effective field theory studied this problem, people like Mark Weiss, Anish Manohar, and Ben Greenstein, and my advisor, Ira Rostein, and lots of people before they even thought about gravity, is to think about these heavy quarks as external sources of glue. So these guys are basically, because they're heavy, the masses are much larger than the QCD scale, then you can think about them basically to feel unperturbed by exchanging just one gluon. So the typical momentum of that gluon that will be at the order 1 over r, it's not going to disturb them because basically the scale m, which is the short distance scale of these guys, is much, much bigger. So they basically move non-relativistically. So the typical momentum exchange between the two, which is order mb, is separated from the short distance physics m. So the effective field theorist here sees a separation of scales and realizes, I can treat one of these scales one at a time. And in fact, the binding energy is also V down with respect to the typical momentum scale in the system. So there you see there's a very nice separation of scales. This is my short distance physics. And then in the jargon of particle physics, I integrate that out and I expand in powers of 1 over m. That's what people do in heavy quark effective theory. Then I see the scale 1 over r and the scale of the binding energy. So you see that the typical momentum is much, much bigger than the typical binding energy. And then we go into something called NRQCD or non-relativistic QCD, in which you can treat this perturbatively in powers of V. Like these guys are moving with a velocity less than 1, and therefore I can expand in powers of v. So the same happens here. Exactly the same mapping between the heavy quarks happens in the gravitational case. Yes. Well, there are different versions of NRQCD, but in this case, for my purpose, let's not go there. So what I want to emphasize here is that the typical energy in the bound state is smaller with respect to the typical momentum. So you can think of this typical exchange of glue as being, for the force, as being instantaneous, because the typical energy or the P0 component is much, much less than the typical P. So what this is telling you is that you can treat this as a non-relativistic system where some instantaneous nonlinear forces that you can expand in powers of B. And exactly the same happens here. So we have the short distance physics, the scale M for us is the scale of the Schwarzschild radius, or the scale Gm for a compact source. The scale of the bound state is the scale, precisely the scale 1 over R. And the scale of the radiation, which is also the time variation of the field, which is also down by a power of B with respect to this scale, because the typical radiation wavelength of radiation compared to the typical separation is also down by a factor of B. Now you might ask me, wait a second, QCD, there is no radiation here. But you can think of QED. So you can do the same with NRQED, and then you can compute the radiation of the system by precisely using the same techniques. Another thing that you can ask me is, but wait a second, this is fully quantum, this is classical. Well, I don't care. As long as I keep the powers of H bar away, I can compute and use the same techniques that I use here to solve for this problem. So that's the basic idea. Lots of people studied this problem before. Walter Goldberg and Ira Ruskin basically said, aha, why don't we use these techniques to solve for this problem and try to make it systematic? Try to disentangle all the physics from all the different scales in the problem in an effective field theory approach and treat it one at a time. So this is a little bit of the formal part of how this is done. I know many of you are not familiar with this. So if you haven't seen path integrals before, I explain a little bit more here what I mean by these computations. But those of you that have seen path integrals before, what this really means is that, okay, I'm going to compute the path integral. Basically, I'm going to compute this vacuum to vacuum amplitude. But I'm going to do it in the classical approximation, which means I'm going to look at the saddle point. So I basically work at zero order in H bar. So then I compute the effective action by integrating out all those gluons that I said before, or all those gravitons, which come in different flavors. We have gravitons that want to be potentials. They want to be at the scale 1 over R that I was telling you before. And I have gravitons that want to be radiation, gravitons that want to go in a much longer scale, lambda radiation. So that's how we do this. We split this integral into pieces and we compute this effective action. Now, the first thing that you have to ask me is like, wait a second, that's very nice. But in the case of QCD, those are fundamental particles. You have these quarks. In the case of black holes, they have some internal structure. In the case of a neutron star, even more. There's a lot of dynamics going on inside the objects. So I had to tell you what I mean by S before I do this integral. So it has two pieces. One is obviously the Einstein-Hilbert part, and the other part is the part when I'm going to treat these particles in the point particle, these black holes and neutron stars, in a point particle approximation, the same way that we treat the T mu as a delta source in the case of the traditional approach. But now I'm going to do it consistently at the level of the action, which means I'm going to write an action that includes the point particle approximation, including all the finite size effects that enter in the dynamics. But the cool thing is that because we're looking at this from very far away, or if you want, because the probe of each guy is the companion, and the companion is at a distance r much, much bigger than the size of the object, I can make an expansion in R Schwarzschild over R, or the size of the object over R. But remember, that is V squared. So I can also parameterize this as an expansion in powers of V. Everything turns out to be an expansion in powers of V, because all these scales turn out to be related by powers of V, which is the cool thing. So now let me tell you how we do the computation, or how do we extract the relevant pieces of information. So if you remember from quantum mechanics, this is very simple. So we're computing here an amplitude, which basically vacuum to vacuum means there is the boundary conditions in this path integral is no radiation in, no radiation out. And then you can say, but wait a second, you want to compute the gravitational well emitted, the radiation. How come you're going to use boundary conditions where there's nothing in and nothing out? Nothing in and nothing out. Well, the cool thing is because this path integral, this amplitude, in the presence of external sources, which for us, my external sources, I was saying before, for the quarks, are the black holes. It basically carries all the information about the dynamics, not only about the potential energy or the binding energy, also about the power loss, which, remember, is what enters in the phase. So if I can compute this perturbatively in powers of V to all orders using this trick, I get this path integral, I compute this vacuum to vacuum amplitude, I read off from the real part the potential, from the imaginary part, I read off the power loss. And now let me tell you why this is the case. Well, if you remember from quantum mechanics, you're going to compute an amplitude. If there was no source, this would be nothing. This would be normalized to one. There's a normalization factor here, a C wave function, but don't care. Now I have sources. What does that mean? That those sources are going to produce the states, basically what are here I'm treating as a vacuum. However, I'm going to basically consider the following situation. I have this black hole. It's emitting something. And now somehow there's like a mirror, say, and it bounces back and gets reabsorbed. In particle physics, we call that computing like the self-energy. So that guy has the potential energy, or the energy is like typical, this is an evolution in quantum mechanics, e to the I Hamiltonian times time, or the Hamiltonian knows about the energy. However, there is an imaginary part. If you think about that self-energy, there is what is called a cat. So that imaginary part knows about the power loss, because that cat, that imaginary part, is like the square of the amplitude, and that's what we want to compute. So all the information is essentially here. The cool thing is that you don't have to mention H bars or anything, even though there are H bars here. At the end of the day, this is fully classical. Okay, so the first scale that I was telling you about is this, what do I mean by the action? So then I'll tell you how to do this computation, but first of all, I need to tell you what is the action that enters here, Einstein-Hilbert, and what about the point particle approximation, which is what is giving us all the problems with the divergences. Well, for us, there is a lot of cool physics inside neutron stars, which I'm trying to summarize here. Lots of very interesting physics that, for me, is going to go and shrink all into one number, actually two numbers. So for me, what I'm going to do is to lead in order a point particle action would be m d tau. So I'm going to treat the neutron star or the black holes like as a multiple expansion, the same way that I was telling you before. Because these guys are going to be probed by the companions, which are at a distance r away from them, this is an expansion like in distance over the size. Or if I think about any kind of probe of my wall line action, where the frequency times r is much, much less than 1. So I'm really probing this guy with a long wavelength. In that approximation, I can treat my point particle as an md tau, but I also could include higher dimensional operators to encode that short distance physics. This is the same way you'll do it in particle physics. I know my low energy physics. How is the high energy physics encoded in my action? I include a bunch of higher dimensional terms. Now, Wilson told me what the information about the short distance physics is. It's in a bunch of Wilson coefficients. Why? Because of the coupling. From very far away, all the short distance physics just goes into a number. How do we get those numbers, though? By the way, this is the electric and magnetic component of the Weyl tensor. If you were talking about electromagnetism and you were looking about a charged star, it would be exactly the same. I will write here electric square and magnetic square, and this guy will be the finite size effects induced by electromagnetic interactions. In the case of gravity, I can give you a picture of how this works. What's happening here is that this is going to get deformed, so it's going to get a quadrupole, but that quadrupole is essentially produced by the metric itself for the companion. That's one power of E, and that quadrupole now couples to the electric component of the Weyl tensor, which is essentially the same as saying that it would generate a dipole, and that dipole now would couple to the electric field. To read off these coefficients, what we do essentially is do the matching. So you can put something in the full theory, so someone has to handle some information, because there's a lot of physics going on in here, and you have these two parameters to fit. But now it's just two numbers. So you don't have to solve the full dynamics of the black hole binary to get these numbers. These numbers you can get from a matching computation. Compute something in the full theory, much, much, much simpler. Say scattering off the black hole or the neutron star. Do now the expansion that I was telling you this expansion is valid for in the low frequency approximation. Then you get something. Now compute an effective theory. This effective theory is super trivial. It's just one diagram. And you get something that has two powers of, from each guy, you have two powers of frequency. You get omega to the 4, but you square it to get the cross section. And now you see the dependence on C, you compare with this guy, and right away you know which order this guy enters, which is a 5 powers of the size. Now, if you remember, I've been emphasizing the size GM, size of R, which is the expansion parameter that I'm using, is essentially all these powers of V. Therefore, I can prove in two lines of theorem, finite size effects for compact objects will first enter at 5 p.m. or order V to the 10. Why? Because I have 5 powers of R here. Now, I should make a comment here that for the case of black holes and in 4 dimension, Misha and Barak and Damur and Nagar and Binnington and Eric, it's not here, they show that actually this coefficient vanishes. So, but not for neutron stars, for the case of black holes. But it's not true for higher dimensions, but although we live in 4 dimensions anyway. So it seems to be an accident. It's not true that this guy vanishes either. But the cool thing is that I don't have to do any work to tell you right away at which order the finite size effects will start to contribute for a neutron star. And what about the case of a spin, which is the most interesting and exciting property of the black hole? Well, it turns out that for a spin, the finite size effects enter a much lower order. Then you can learn a lot about the physics of a spin from finite size effects from gravitational waves, thanks to the fact that spin doesn't need this extra power of E. Because spin itself will generate that quadruple that I was telling you you needed the companion for. For those of you that are more technically oriented, you know that these guys have to enter with 2 powers of H. You could not get this guy with only 1 power of H, because if that was the case, if I use this theory to recover the Schwarzschild metric, which would be to compute the 1-point function instead of the 2-point function, then you get the M in your metric, but you also get a bunch of coefficients. And you know Birkhoff's theorem tells you these coefficients cannot contribute to the metric. Therefore, they only enter in the 2-point function. Now, that's not the case for the black hole with spin. Why? Because you rotate. Then you generate the quadruple. Therefore, you do get terms that couple with the spin linear to the electric component of the violet tensor, or the same way that you do it with a charge, they will couple to the electric field. Well, it will take me a whole talk to explain how spin is actually, I mean, it's a very nice talk about spin, black hole spin and so on, but spin in GR has a long history. It's a complicated subject. So I'm not going to talk about the details. That was my thesis. But I'm going to tell you what is the main idea, what is the take-home picture of how spin, how we're going to treat spin in the problem, and why it was so hard for the traditional approach, and why it's so much simpler for us to compute with include the spin, which, as we learned from Professor Narayan, is the exciting part of the black holes. So what happens is you have the MD tau, we have the finite size effects, and we have to couple spin now to gravity. Well, it turns out that you can show that it couples to the spin connection, and you have a tensor, an S mu nu tensor that couples spin to gravity. Now you must ask right away, this is an antisymmetric tensor, you have too many components, you only have a vector for a spin. How do you reduce this guy into just 3 degrees of freedom? And that's what the dot, dot, dot is for. So you have what is called like second class constraints or spin supplementarity conditions. You have to impose that condition that you only have 3 degrees of freedom at the level of the action. And that's a slightly more complicated part that I'm not going to explain. But this is way simpler than the way that the ADF formalism treats spin. I challenge you to read their papers. So the cool thing is that I can do the matching again. But now it's even simpler, because remember here I had to do the 2-point function, or the way that Misha and Barak did. You can do something similar if you have some background. So you can put a background insertion here, and then you compute a 1-point function. But essentially, it's sensitive to a 2-point function. Here, now I'm sensitive to the 1-point function, because this guy now enters in the Kerr metric. And this is just the quadruple of the Kerr metric. In fact, you can do the matching for the Kerr metric, and you get 1 over 2m. This coefficient for black holes is 1 over 2m. Very simple. And now I know, just for power counting techniques, for all these powers of B that I'm trying to emphasize, I understand how to account for in the effective field theory approach. I know that this is all you need to go to next to linear order or 3 p.m. In fact, this already enters at 2 p.m. There is nothing else up to 3 p.m. This is beautiful, because now I know that I have one term that I already did the matching for, and I can compute up to 3 p.m. all the contributions from finite size effect from a spinning black hole with nothing else. This is highly arbitrary, complicated, and traditional approach. In fact, okay, let's not go there. I'm just saying, here is way clearer and simpler. Yeah. There is a free parameter. This one? Oh, this is a spin coupling to gravity. This you can get, for example, yeah, this is like the leading order coupling between spin and gravity. It's just kinematic. Yeah. This is to recover the Papapetro equations, for example, which are fixed. Okay, good. So this is how we handle the first scale that I was telling you about. Remember this scale, the size of GM that you have to integrate out the same way that in heavy power effective theory you integrate out the mass. That's how we do it. We write an action that includes these terms. We know how to get the coefficients. Yes? Second? Sure. This term? This term? 1, 2, 3? This is all on the world line, yes. It's
on the world line. So yes. There's many, in general, there'll be many world lines, at least two. So you have a sun.
Oh, no, but the other guy is far away, right? So you have two world lines, two black holes orbiting.
Yeah, so don't you have to have a sum of the such terms?
Oh, yeah, this is going to have, sure. It's C1 and C2. I put it here with an I. C1, this I counts the number of particles that you have. Yes, sorry. Yes. So this is what I wanted to emphasize here is that you can get this coefficient for just one guy without looking at the companion. You don't have to look at the companion. You don't have to solve the binary problem to get these numbers. You can just look at one star, you get the number, you put them in the binary, and you make a prediction. That was what I wanted to emphasize. Yes, thank you. So cool, that's how we treat the finite side. How do we treat the potential mode, which is the 1/r force between the two particles? Well, this is what I was telling you before, the typical potential, if you remember from the quark case, the typical exchange, momentum exchange is mb, but the typical binding energy is mb squared. So the typical p0, if you want to compute, for example, a one graviton exchange between the quarks, the typical p0, the typical energy, is much, much less than p. So I can expand it in powers of p0. So what we're doing here is that we're treating all these diagrams here that are basically account for the force in the approximation in which they are all instantaneous. So we call these potential modes. The P0 is much, much less than the P, and that's what the dashed line is accounting for. So then it's very easy. This is the part when we do the integral over the metric, or basically we're solving for the vacuum-to-vacuum amplitude in the presence of external sources. So this is vacuum-to-vacuum. I want to emphasize, there is no propagating degree of freedom here. This is just your source. You could think of this as insertions of the source if you want. So you're computing your vacuum-to-vacuum amplitude, including now the part that I was telling you that accounts for the force, for the potential mode. And for example, here we recover the famous Einstein-Ife-Hoffmann action. They give us the first 1PN correction to the 1/r potential. Here you see this cross accounts for this departure from instantaneity. These are the nonlinear interactions, this in Einstein action, this in the MD tau, because the tau is a square root. So when you span in the metric, you get Siegel type diagrams. And these Vs are expansions of the T mu nu that I was telling you before. Because of the MD tau, it has powers of V. And this is answering your question. This is the first PN correction. So the potential now is no longer 1/r. It has 1/r times V squared and 1/r squared terms. However, as long as the velocity is small, all these corrections are gm over r down with respect to the linear order guy, which would be this guy without the 2 and with a 1 here. Therefore, as long as gm over r is less than 1, I can treat this perturbatively, and that's what we're doing. Gm over r is power of b squared. The next correction goes like gm over r down with respect to that guy, and it's v squared. And this is essentially Einstein-Ife-Hoffmann. How do we treat the radiation scale? Well, this is the last scale. We already solved for the potential. So we're looking now at this problem from very far away. This is now our radiation guy. From very far away, now the binary looks like a point particle. As I was telling you before, from the scale of the companion, this guy looks like a point particle. But now from the scale of the radiation, the whole thing looks like a point particle. And now the radiation modes are the ones that we observed. So these guys are on shell. Those are different regions of the Feynman diagrams, if you want. As an effective theorist, you usually divide those Feynman diagrams in regions, where the typical momentum scales with powers of the scaling parameter. In this case, the radiation guy is a much, much longer wavelength. So how do I write an action? The same way that I was writing an action before for the neutron star, how do I write an action that describes the binary? Well, I do a multiple expansion. I work in a long wavelength effective theory. Now, instead of having the E squared type of operators, I have a bunch of multiples. So I have the same MD tau, I have the same spin coupling, but now the spin coupling is not only the spin of the guys, but also the angular momentum. And now I have a bunch of multiple moments. All these multiple moments encode the short distance physics for the long wavelength radiation. That short distance physics now is the whole binary. So how do we get these guys? Oh, by the way, now once you write this theory, it doesn't have to be a binary. anything with a multiple, this is defective action. So anything that has a time-varying multiple, this is what I will write down, and this is how it will compute the power. This works no matter what kind of system you have at hand. This is just the separation between the short-distance physics of the multiple scale from the long-distance physics of the radiation. So I was telling you before, this vacuum-to-vacuum carries the information about the power loss from the imaginary part. Well, I'm computing that self-energy that I told you before. I compute the imaginary part, and that, for example, recovers the quadruple formula. And you can do it to all orders if you want. Now, a more technical point is that to really get those quadruples, those multiples, those basically are sourced by the TMNU. So you have to open up and go into your short-distance physics now. How are you going to compute those multiples as moments of the TMNU? And now this is tricky because each multiple, this is the usual one, right? This is the quadruple. This is MXX trace free that you're happy with, that you all know. But what happens is that this is an expansion now in R over lambda, which again is all expanded in B. But if you're not talking about the binary case, it's an expansion between the size of the scale of the multiple, in this case the Xs, and the scale of the radiation. So that expansion has all these terms by itself. Because basically you have to organize this in representations of SU3 and symmetric trace free tensors so that you know eventually at which order each term of the multiple expansion is going to enter. This is done systematically in a series of papers, and Andreas Ross recently worked out this to all orders. But now this is an expansion R over lambda. That doesn't know anything about V. Now we go to the binary case, we know that R over lambda is V. So we know that each one of these guys will be done by powers of V. But now each one of the TMNU themselves are also powers of V. So this is a very nice systematic way of organizing the computation. We know how to multiple expand my action in the log wavelength approximation, and we know how to compute each one of these guys in powers of V themselves. And to do that, we compute the one-point function. Okay, good. So I'll stop now and tell you that so far this is very nice. So if Feynman were here, he would say, well, that's very nice, but what can you do with it? Because I have recovered Einstein-Effel-Hoffmann, which is like 75 years old, and the quadruple radiation. So I'm going to now tell you the new physics, the new results. Sorry, not new physics, the new result. So we basically, with these techniques, we were able to solve for the dynamics of spinning compact objects to next to linear order, to 3PM. And this is now very simple. And this, we not only include higher order effects in spin, we also include the finite size effects. At the time, this we computed in a series of papers. These were all new results. And eventually, this was reproduced in the tradition formalism by Schaefer and Steinhoff and company. And very recently, they put a paper where they claim that we all agree, so we're very happy. By the way, the next to leading order spin potentials have also been computing within the effective field theory formalism and the ADF formalism by Michel Levy and by Jan Steinhoff. I also reproduced some spin orbit results at 2PM that had been computed by Bonanno, Blanchet, and Fay in 2006, which also is complicated. You have to have a TMNU for this, the spinning black holes. You have to have the Papa-Petri equation. You have to solve it. You have to regularize it. It's a mess. For me, actually, this took me a weekend, and I reproduced the result. And it's very, very simple and systematic now because I understand at which order everything enters. Now we have new results also for the gravitational wave power. This is the last scale that I was telling you before. When you do the matching and you have to compute all these one-point functions, for example, this is the quadruple moment, including high dimensional corrections that account for the finite size effects. All this is new results. Nobody has computed this, and I don't think they will catch up with us in the future. We just computed, for example, the contributions to the amplitude. Everything that I just told you enters in the phase because that's the binding energy and the flux that I use to compute the phase. Well, what about the amplitude? Well, we also computed corrections to the amplitude. This paper is going to come up soon. This is very, very nice because it also includes effects which are called tail effects that includes the scattering of the geometry. And there are some infrared divergences here to handle, which in the effective theory formalism are very nice. There are UV divergences that also enter in the power that you can resum. There's a beautiful paper by Andreas Ross and Walter Goldberg where they resum all these tail effects to very high order. And Andy talked about that during the workshop, which matches very complicated computations in black hole perturbation theory. So where we stand, where we're at now, let me tell you what we know. So far we know essentially the templates, I'm here, I'm giving you the information in terms of the number of cycles. Remember that the number of cycles was of the order of like 10,000 within the LIGO band for binary neutron stars, which is roughly what I'm plotting here, what I call the Newtonian. For 10 solar mass black holes, though, the number of cycles shrinks considerably. So it's very important to have accurate templates for like 10 solar mass black holes, which is what Professor Narayan showed us. Like mostly the black holes wants to live here. So what has been done is up to 3PN, spin 2PN, spin orbit 2.5 that I was telling you before, and up to 3PN now, the spin results that we computed are going to basically close everything. So without resolve, we're going to have the accurate waveforms up to 2.5 3PN order, which is next one in the order, including spin. And this is very cool because we can do everything that I told you before about spin to very high accuracy. For example, measure spin, most accurate test of GR, and blah, blah, blah. So let me very briefly show you, I mean, why we're so excited about this. But let me show you how Einstein computed the Einstein-Infeld-Hoffmann action. So by the way, here's a little bit of advertising. This is Einstein and Infeld talking about the motion of particles and general relativity, which is of fundamental importance. So if Einstein says so, we try to solve the problem. And there's this guy, Lewison, who I never heard of, but he pointed out to them that from the approximation procedure, it does not follow the field equations can be solved up to an arbitrary high approximation. So this is what now we say about the traditional approach. That's indeed true. The traditional approach is not obvious how to systematically compute to higher orders. We believe that the present work, now I'm talking about our work, not only removes this difficulty, but it gives us a new and deeper insight into the problem of motion. From the logical point of view, the present theory is considerably simpler. I hope I convey a much simpler description of how this works and clearer than the old one. But as always, we might pay for these logical simplifications by prolonging the chain of technical arguments. I had to use field theory and effective theory developments that came in the 80s, so it took a little while. Einstein didn't know much about that, but let me show you how they computed the 1PN correction to the orbit. That potential that I showed you before is a series of surface integrals, very complicated series of surface integrals. Let me remind you how we computed it. And let me also remind you that this is what enters, for example, there was one of the first tests of GR in the precession of the perihelion, which is not mostly Einstein-Infeld-Hoffmann, it's actually mostly Jupiter. But the cool thing here is that because we have precise measurements of GR, we were able to tell that Jupiter wasn't enough. And we discovered essentially the modifications of Newtonian gravity. So precise measurements are very important to discover new physics and to learn about the dynamics of black holes, in this case, the motion of Mercury around the sun. So I hope I convince you that famous bookkeeping and effective theory is really efficient and useful. Let me show you, for example, how do you do the 3PN results. This was reproduced by Fofa and Sturani recently, that it took Damour and company like some 5 to 10 years to compute. It took them, I think, 6 months. And they're now undergoing the 4PN computations. Okay, so this is basically how we solve for the problem of motion, how the, we study the gravitational wave, the effective theory for gravitational wave emission within NRGR. So I don't think I have much time left. So let me just tell you one more cool application and then jump into conclusions where I will review the other applications that we will be working on. How do we describe, for example, dissipation or absorption in this formalism? Because this is very nice. But you told me about the forces, you told me about the radiation. What about dissipation? What about like tidal effects, tidal and absorption effects? So very nice, we have these E-square operators in the one line, but those don't discrete dissipation, because to discrete dissipation, eventually you have to think about that you can dissipate even to very, very low frequencies. So there is no gap. You have a series of gapless modes. So you cannot like naively integrate them out. So you have to unintegrate them out. So how do we do that? And this is very nice. This is essentially an idea that Walter and I also worked out, is that what about we treat black holes now, again, as a one line, as a point particle? So we're going to do a duality. We're going to say, OK, we have a 3 plus 1 black hole, but we're going to treat it as 0 plus 1 field theory. So this is in the spirit of ADS-CFT. So now I have a theory that lives in the one line. So how do I compute, how do I get the physics of the black hole from this theory? Well, by computing correlation functions. The same way, for example, that Klebanov computed the cross-section, the absorption cross-section from the book, like shining gravitons at the brain in terms of a field theory living on the brain, correlators of the TMNU. Now I'm going to have correlators of this Q. And this is very cool. And in fact, if you do it for a spin, it's even cooler because there is super radiance. And you can understand super radiance now very nicely in terms of this dual field theory. And that is what I did. And you can compute the power of absorption. For example, once you do the matching, once you start this correlator from the physics of the black hole, for example, by computing the cross-section of absorption, which is spin done. It was done in the 70s. Once somebody handles you that information, now I know and I can predict the power of absorption in the binary system by plugging now those diagrams that I was telling you before. Now, this is no longer the signal that I had before. That would be the correction from a local operator, from a finite size. Now it has this correlator in it. And the cool thing is that Eric computed this, and I think it's slightly more complicated than the way that I did it. Once you enter the information from the matching, it's just one line to get this result for the power of absorption in the binary system, which is highly complicated in the more traditional approach. And you can not only do it for spinning black holes, you can do it also for neutron stars. And then you can learn a lot about this function, this cross-section, the absorption cross-section for a neutron stars, measuring the power of absorption from gravitational waves. You can learn a lot about the inner structure of the neutron stars. You can learn a lot about the equation of the states of the neutron star from gravitational wave measurements. Now, this is very cool, and I'm not going to have time to tell you about the effect of its theory applications and Gaussian boson, but in fact, just let me tell you the following. This idea here, we apply it to the effect of its theory of inflation, which is an effect of its theory to compute density fluctuations in terms of Gaussian bosons, basically saying that the curvature perturbations are like the longitudinal Ws, which is like the metric perturbation, the scalar metric perturbations that enter in the computation of the temperature fluctuations. Those you can treat in terms of Gaussian bosons the same way that you can treat the longitudinal Ws in terms of Gaussian bosons. There's very beautiful work that I'm not going to have much time to talk about. But the cool thing is because Planck is going to measure non-Gaussianities, and effective field theory essentially is a model-independent way to study the physics of inflation. Maybe we can put bounds or understand, for example, the size of non-Gaussianities for generic models of inflation in a completely model-independent way. So I was saying this key observation of the effective field theory of inflation is that you can treat these metric fluctuations that are enter in the computation of the temperature fluctuations in terms of Gaussian bosons that basically get eaten by the metric fluctuations. And again, a little bit technical, in the high energy limit, which is for us is Hubble, we can compute correlation functions using this equivalence theorem, which tells you that the WW scattering is like a Gaussian boson scattering at energies much bigger than the mass of the W. Something very similar occurs here. I can compute everything in terms of these Gaussian bosons. However, this is only for models of single clock inflation, in which you have one clock or one single Gaussian guy. What happens if you add more fields? So if you're going to go beyond the standard model, and this we studied together with Leonardo and Matthias, how do we treat this effective theory of inflation if you not include, for example, dissipation? If you allow this rolling field, for example, to start interacting with other stuff and dissipating. And now we had already the tools to study this in the case of the black hole dynamics, so we can right away apply it to the case of the effective theory of inflation. Remember how it worked here. So we work this, we couple this pion field to the new degrees of freedom, which are the same as the Qs. We need to match, we have to get these correlators. So don't be scared by this. All I want to tell you is that you can study now models of dissipation during inflation in a completely model independent way. And the take home lesson from this approach, or why the effective field theory is so useful, is because we can parameterize, for example, how the two-point function looks like, which has nothing to do with the Banach-Stevens state now. So what happens if the two-point function that was seven discussed is not produced by vacuum fluctuations in the Banach-Stevens state? Well, you have to have, for example, thermal noise, or you can have, for example, noise produced by particle production during inflation. How do you parameterize all those possible models, like a trap inflation or warm inflation, if that rings a bell for any of you, in a model-independent way? Well, we wrote an effective theory for it, and that tells you right away that data that we measure in the sky today has nothing to do with Hubble and this rho parameter. It knows about physics, which is completely unrelated to the Banach-Stevens state. It knows about the two-point function of this nose, for example, which if you write in terms of the temperature, it knows about the temperature. And you can also learn about non-Gaussianities. The cool thing about this effective theory approach is that I don't know what the two-point function is. I don't know what the three-point function is, the actual size. But I do know, for example, what is the level of non-Gaussianities in my signal, because I can just take the ratio. We do this in particle physics all the time. All the stuff that I don't know cancels out. And then I get an FNL, or the non-Gaussianities of order of the dissipation coefficient over Hubble, which is 1 over C squared is what you get in single field inflation. Now you get a factor of gamma over H bigger. But not only that, the shape or the way we're going to see this in the spectrum with Planck, it also changes dramatically compared to the single field inflation models, because you have now contributions at folded triangles, which is when the three-point function is parameterized in terms of this bispectrum that conserves momentum. So this is essentially a triangle. These triangles change the shape, and that has to do where this function peaks. And these are folded triangles. And this is very cool because you don't get this peak in Banach-Davis state. So if you can actually observe this in the data, then you know that this is a smoking gun for physics, for the primordial sea to be due to something completely unrelated to the vacuum state, or vice versa. You might be able to tell for sure that all we see today is a quantum fluctuation. And this is a work in progress. Okay, I'm not gonna have much time. I think I'm slightly running out of time about telling you also applications in high energy scattering. Steve and I, for example, been trying to guess what the gravitational S matrix look like in processing super Planckian energies. A Planck scale, we don't really know, stringy, blah, blah, blah. But if you go to very high energies, then you can use semi-classical ideas trying to guess what the S matrix look like. And we basically studied this strong gravity regime. But then recently we've been interested in this regime, what is called the Iconal regime, in which you go very high energies, but the impact parameter is larger than the Schwarzschild radius. And we use an idea similar to South Korea effective theory to basically study this now in gravity and to compute the radiation, for example, the PERP radiation, which you can treat perturbatively, which is soft. That's what is usually called Glauber modes in the effective theory, or potential modes in the language that I told you before. And for the soft and collinear parts, you also have the same. There is a soft part that you can compute the same way that we compute the radiation before. But now the expansion parameter is no longer the velocity. The expansion parameter is the expansion parameter that I said at the beginning was gm over r, which happens to be v in the case of the binary system. But gm over the impact parameter now is the scattering angle in this problem. So we have an effective theory in powers of setup, but the ideas are very similar. You also have to match into jets because you have a lot of collinear radiation in the directions. But this is very cool because let me just put the summary here. This is very cool because in principle, you can apply this to many, many, many very interesting problems in gravity, not just from a conceptual point of view, which is if you have an S matrix for gravity, it has to have the strong gravity regime, the Iconal regime, the large impact parameter regime. All of this has to be there in that S matrix. But also because this type of problems might be realized in nature. This type of techniques might help you to, for example, find a hybrid approach between numerical GR and analytic techniques, because as you approach merger, you might think of these guys as basically high energy collisions in this case, for example, I didn't say much about, but if you see, as you go to high energy, the field lines pancake, these are called equivalence hexametric. So that's the word I was looking for. A high energy, you can think of these guys as being like two shock waves colliding near merger. And these techniques might actually be very useful. Not only because they're nice in general, because as a fundamental problem, also in practice. Okay, so that's my summary. So effective field theory techniques provide a very powerful organizational principle to separate the relevant physics from different scales. This is what I'm trying to emphasize. You see different scales. Usually you think about effective theory about parameterizing new physics. Oh, I'm going to write this high dimensional term that parameterizes new physics. And in fact, we did sort of that, because for the neutron stars, we don't know the equation state. We had to write this high dimensional operator. However, effective theory only allows you to separate scales within a problem that you know. QCD, we know. And we still can separate the scales and treat effective theories like heavy quark effective theory or non-relativistic QCD, because we know there is a separation of scales, which in the case of QCD was these powers of velocity. And in the case of the binary system, the same happened. We have the separation of scales between the finite size, the radiation, and the orbit scale. And that's when effective theories are very, very, very helpful, because we can treat each one at a time. Not only that, it gives us a natural way to regularize the theory, which I didn't talk about because it will take me also another talk, is because those coefficients that I added as high dimensional terms in fact, are the counter terms that would absorb all the divergences in the problem. And that's why I can show, for example, that for spinless bodies, you won't reach any divergences until V to the 10, because that's when you get the first finite size correction. And then you get the RG flow that I didn't talk about either, is how you go between one scale and the other. It's because those coefficients run. There is a scale dependence that you have to introduce in the problem. But effective theory essentially is tailor-made to handle all this very systematically. We not only solve the problem and reproduce most of the old stuff within a couple of years, we came up with new results very rapidly. And we gave basically the most accurate description of a spin invariant system today, which is up to 3 p.m., which is going to be very important, in particular if you have, for example, tensor mass black holes, in which the number of cycles is of the orders of 1,000. So you really need to have very accurate templates. I also talked about effective theory and black hole dualities, how nice it is, for example, to describe the black hole in terms of this dual theory that knows about all the internal dynamics of the black hole, that tell you about dissipation and absorption. In fact, this might be connected to this Kerr CFT theory, which happens to be 1 plus 1, but it's in a completely different regime. You see, the frequency that they take is order m. This is a stream case. We are talking about the multiple expansion, the low frequency approximation, so we don't see, if you want, that extra dimension. So we have a 0 plus 1 theory, but we have all the correlators. So we have a field theory. What does it mean? This is going to teach us a lot about what black holes, these black hole dualities are. For inflation, the effective theory approach allows you to describe modern inflation in a complete unifying framework and parameterize this new physics the same way you do it with electric precision data. And this is something that Leonardo and company, Senatore and Matias Aldera, have been emphasizing. But what we did was add all these ideas about dissipation, and study now extended this effective theory of single field inflation to include the parts of branch steady state, basically to include the possibility of this Goldstone boson, this clock that it takes care of the expansion of the universe, that it could interact with other particles, like you have multi-field inflation. For the gravitational S-matrix case, there's also a systematic effective theory approach to study the large impact parameter, which might be very helpful to study the onset of black hole formation in the case of coalescence in binary black hole mergers, but also, for example, to understand QCD via ADS QCD, because if you study these shock waves, you have an analytic way to solve for the dynamics of the high energy collision of shock waves in ADS, then you might be able to say something about QCD. So that's where effective theory methods might be useful, and also as a hybrid approach between numerical GR analytic methods, and we're using the effective theory forever. So we're basically trying to now study structure formation, cosmological perturbation, and now since I talk a lot about dissipative effects, we do not have an action that includes dissipative effects for hydrodynamics. Can we run effective field theory that also includes dissipative effects in hydrodynamics? And that's all work in progress. And thank you very much for your attention. Sorry if I went over there.
Question?
Yes.
So you mentioned, so first of all, how you worked out to TPN order the equations for two spinning bodies for a
yes.
binary system.
Yes.
And then also talked about later on about the super radiance and how to describe that in this EFT language.
Yes. CFT, you know, EFT, yeah.
So have you, so can you combine those two and work out how a binary system will evolve if you have spin and super radiance is relevant?
Well, for example, for the binary case, this super radiance effect is very nice because if you compute the power of absorption due to for non-spinning bodies, it turns out the power of absorption is too high. So you basically LIGO won't see it. So that effects of absorption are almost irrelevant. But for spin, because of the super radiant effect, you get an enhancement. And the power of absorption turns out to be like 4 p.m. So it's actually much lower, which means that you might not see it, but it could be in the future eventually, if LISA flies perhaps, you might be able to see the effects of super radiance in the waveforms from the absorption effect. Now, this is a 3 p.m. effect in the dynamics that enters in the phase, right? This is if you want a lower order effect. Dissipation is a much higher effect for the binary black hole case. So you won't see it directly. I'm not sure whether that's the, what you had in mind. So this is the dynamics of binary black hole. Now, that's the cool thing about effective theory. I know which order everything enters. So I tell you, okay, dissipation, at which order enters? I can do the power counting and tell you, ah, it's too high. So I will not see it. I will not see it at 3 p.m., say. So at 3 p.m., I know all I need. I know this result for the dynamics. I know this result for the multiple moments. And I know this result for the waveform. I have everything I need. And I split everything in pieces. That was the cool thing. If you try to solve Einstein equations, you have all these scales playing at once, regularization, ambiguities, and so on. Clifford, we have an order of 1,000 parameters, ambiguous parameters he didn't know how to fit. What did they mean? Well, it meant that you didn't have a systematic way to split the problem in pieces. So that's why this was so powerful. And we basically solved the problem up to 3 p.m. We completed everything.
Speaking of the 3 p.m., 2 p.m., what order the LIGO connection measure? What is the precision of LIGO connection?
Well, that's a very good question. For detection, all these results, I think, for neutron stars or solar mass black holes are not relevant for detection. Now, for parameter estimation, right, to get the scientific output of this endeavor of gravitational astronomy, these results we translate on precision on this parameter. And for example, with 3 p.m. result, and this is something that is being that people are working on, how accurate can you measure the masses and spin? This is going to translate into a 1% measurements in mass and spin.
The question is, would you really be limited by the precision of the theory or the precision of the experiment?
Well, in this case, LIGO itself, I think, LIGO itself, when you enter, yeah, I think 3 p.m., they can see up to 3 p.m. Yes, people claim that for a spinless, for example, you will. I think more 4 p.m. would. I don't think 4 p.m. would be seen by LIGO. I think 3 p.m. Yes.
Huh? By this coming LIGO.
By this coming LIGO. Yeah. 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 3 p.m. would be seen.
Well, it depends on what system you're thinking about. If it is lower mass or higher
mass, exactly. So neutron
nice
star.
Frequency
yeah.
The merger in respect to the bucket of your sensitivity.
Because if you have neutron stars, you do have a lot of cycles and you have a signal to noise ratio. So those you're going to see very well. But then if you increase the masses and so on, then you can fewer cycles, less time in the band. But this is people discuss these things. The way I look at it is like, well, eventually LISA would be fantastic, almost, I mean, 5 p.m., 6 p.m., eventually. But in terms of LIGO, advanced LIGO, for like tensor mass black hole and so on, these results are going to be very important. This is the ocean. Yes. Well, I don't know. Sure. Yeah.
Is it related?
It's just a continuation of what I asked earlier. So back to this question of when do these dissipative or superradiant effects become relevant?
Yeah.
So I've been interested in this in the context of scalar tensor theories.
Well, but scalar tensor theory, you can see way before you talk about superradiance. What, on the other hand, light particles, as I was saying with axions, for example, that's very cool because it's, you see the way spin works. If you have a spinning black hole, then you have this superradiant effect in which if you have very light particles and the wavelength of those particles is of the order of the size of the black hole, then you induce this superradiant effect and this guy spins down very fast. So you won't see highly rotating black holes with that mass, say. And they will put a bound on the mass of that axion, say. So that's very cool. And there's other things you could do with neutron stars and so on. I don't know if that's where your question is going.
Right. So I think that's this paper about floating orbits. By,
sorry?
This paper about floating and sinking orbits by Emil Radebeinti and
okay.
Also.
Okay.
I think they're essentially talking about the same thing you just mentioned.
Okay.
But the thing is, they didn't use this effective field theory framework to describe it. They were just using
okay.
The old formalism by Vygotsky.
Oh, that's way. That's what I was trying to say. That's what Eric did to compute the power of assertion. That's not what I did. And it's much, much simpler. Okay, you can show me that. I wasn't aware of it. Okay.
But do you know if anybody has tried to do that?
No, not that I'm aware of.
In the context of.
No, no. In fact, well, yes, I am doing it, but not that no one was doing it before. Yeah.
So I had to
yes.
Two questions. One was. I have a feeling of what effective field theory means when you don't have super deep effects, but basically you integrate that all the modes that are beyond the cutoff because you assume they're vacuum.
Perfect. So what is the cutoff of my effective theory varies, depends on which scale I'm looking at.
So now, but then the question that the problem is if you don't if, effects, then all these modes that you're integrating at don't.
I did not integrate them out. That's what I was trying
so
to emphasize.
How are you doing with
them? I kept them. They were right there in front of your eyes.
You keep everything.
Here. It's a time dependent, guys. I need to compute the correlations.
No, but I mean, there are lots of degrees of freedom. It's not
No. It's all. I know the long distance physics. I'm looking from this from far away.
Yeah.
My ultimate goal is to compute gravitational radiation. Now, what's happening inside the black hole? I don't care. What all for me is the symmetries of the long distance physics, which is GR. So basically, that's what determines what kind of terms I can write down. So this is what I say. I have some quadruple moment coupled to the electric component of the Weyl terms. The same way I would write here, a dipole term as an electric
field.
And
how do you model that quadruple?
I don't model it. I do the matching. Someone computed for me, for example, this, the cross-section of absorption for a black hole. Solve with Tarkovsky's equation, all the yada yada. Once you get that information, I compute this in effective theory, and I match. I compare the two, and I get what this guy is. Once I know this function, I put it in my binary, and I make a prediction. Because I already, this is universal. I know how these functions respond to a perturbation. I extract that information from the matching. But look, the matching now is not a number anymore. Because this guy is a long lead and so on, I need this full function. I need this full function is the matching now. It's not a number. So if you want, it's like
it's
a full function.
You think it's just one function is enough?
It is enough.
All
the symmetries determine the tensor structure is just a function.
That's good. So the second question is, when you're talking about gravitational S matrix.
Gravitational what?
Gravitational S matrix.
Yes.
So I mean, we know that when you form black holes, in a sense, you're breaking the unitarity of general relativity.
No, you don't. Hmm? What do you mean?
Well, I mean, when you form black holes.
You mean Hawking radiation.
Well, okay, if you have, so that's not general relativity, that's just quantum, you have to add some quantum.
Oh, you mean classically you
classically
just, you form a black hole, don't decay, yes.
Yeah. So.
Well, but then you can say the information is inside, there's no problem.
So then I'm just wondering what happens to the scattering amplitudes, basically, where you form black holes.
Well, that's precisely what we study here. This is not effective in theory because it's strong dynamics. Here, you have to guess what the amplitude looks like. And that's what we did with Steve. We basically wrote the amplitude, and we try to guess how, for example, let to measure, how do you measure, for example, the absorption coefficients, which basically tell you how the black hole is going to decay into how many states available it has. And then you can guess, well, maybe he knows about the entropy. Maybe the absorption coefficients, when you remember the partial waves, and you have these betas and these
so
deltas.
I'm just wondering, the formation of black holes, would they show up as poles?
There will be poles, yes.
Poles or branch cuts or something else?
Well,
I'm just wondering.
Yeah, no, exactly. So you will have poles, but they're going to have a decay width because they're going to be decay. So you do have poles in the mass, but we have to count how many states you have up to that.
Is it like a continuum of poles? Because
in the approximation with the black hole, where the energy is very, very big, then you can think of a continuous because the decay width is actually much longer. So you're making a very big black hole, so they're long-lived in some sense.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Robert, so your last comment was about quantum gravity, but aside from that, everything was classical, right?
Yeah, because I'm working in a regime away from quantum gravity.
Yeah, so I think there's something confusing about the terminology, right?
Yeah.
Or at least it looks like you're computing, when you say integrating out short distance modes or whatever they may be.
That can do that classically.
Yeah, you really just mean solving the equations of motion for the short distance. There's no actual. Normally, you think that you're taking into account the effects of fluctuations, but I don't think. Is it fair to say you're not really doing that here?
Well, you could do classical fluctuations as well.
You might, but is that what you have done here, or is what you did is just put the short distance modes on shell?
No. Some of the short distance guys are actually off shell. Some of the short distance guys are the forces, right?
Okay,
but I agree with you in the following.
Yeah,
I will rephrase it this way.
Those are still solutions of the Einstein equation.
Yes, I never departed from that.
In that sense, they're still...
That's right. When I integrated over the metric, I was always on the solution.
Now, so it seems to me there's two things going on here. One of them I understand, and the other one I don't understand the need for it. So the first thing is, instead of working with equations of motion, you're working with the action.
Yes.
That often simplifies things.
Very much.
You're saying that it simplifies things here. The second thing is to use techniques from quantum field theory.
Yes.
Feynman diagrams and so on. So I'm a little skeptical whether the second thing is essential or it's just change of language. So the question
Let me just show you the results. I mean, they took 20 years.
The question is, could you have just re-expressed what you did in the language where you didn't actually use Feynman diagrams?
Well, you could if you want.
To define Feynman diagrams in a purely classical way.
Well, they are.
The second must be possible.
I disagree. They are. These Feynman diagrams are classical. You can think of.
Okay, then you could have introduced them without ever talking about gravitons, for example.
I could remove the word graviton. Yeah, I think that's one of the things Eric complains about. Yes, I could have. Talk about this without mentioning the word graviton. Yeah. Yeah, I think the cool thing is.
So, is there a way to introduce the technique without making us think that we're talking about graviton?
It's all the same. Nothing changed except that when you're gonna compute this Einstein solution in the action, which means looking at the saddle point in the way of that writing the path integral, right? It will be like the three-level solution. You will just say, well, I'm going to solve for this part of the physics first. I'm going to split that integral in two pieces. I'm going to integrate of this.
But you're not doing the integral.
I am doing the integral. Of course,
because
I'm doing the integral.
You're just doing a saddle. I mean,
I can still do it. But that's still doing the integral. I'm not studying fluctuations. Well, how do you get classical physics out of it?
That's what I'm asking you.
Well, that's I should show you how I did it.
Okay.
Okay, let me answer the question this way. Ira and Walter put the formalism up in 2004. Let me just do a little bit of history. When this formalism was created in 2004, September 2004, I think. Yes. Right? So it's been 7 years. We basically re-derived everything that has been done. Almost everything has been done. There's one calculation that we haven't finished yet that will pretty much finish everything that has been done. We computed new results within 1 year. Essentially, I didn't write here the new result. Where is the new result?
Well, I'm not questioning, but
No. Let me tell you how we'll answer that question. That eventually, I mean, with more traditional methods and so on, some Einstein equations, they show to agree, and more new results. And more new results. Now you can say, well, you can go ahead and read this again, right? From the logical point of view, the principle is considered simple and clear, but as always, we must pay for these logical simplifications by prolonging the change of technical argument. I mean, I don't know. I like it very much.
Let me ask one other question.
Okay. Yeah.
In the case of inflation, you kind of said that you don't need to know anything about the vacuum state.
About it?
Well, you said it has nothing to do with the vacuum state. But it's impossible that you don't assume something about the state of the quantum field.
No, that's the cool thing. I don't need to assume anything.
That's clearly impossible.
No, it's not. No. Okay, let's finish. Can we talk?
I'm very Raphael. You have to assume
something. I'm also Raphael. Careful. All the information about the Blanchet state is gone because you wait for a lot. You match with the Blanchet state at the beginning.
But you have a different state.
But you have a different state. But that state you reach by exciting the guy. It's not in the vacuum anymore, and the information about the vacuum is completely gone. The homogeneous solution.
For example,
a thermal state or a steady state of particle production. It doesn't have to be thermal. And then you lost all the information about the vacuum. It's completely gone.
Okay, maybe we could thank Raphael. And Raphael, by the way, will be here till tomorrow afternoon. So if anyone wants to keep chatting with him, we're ready. Okay.